Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling and Jason Yannakopoulos is with me too. You're listening to Bristol's first podcast, Dialect, in our Friday afternoon 2pm slot on BCFM 93.2. And this week we go to former British colony Burma to hear about potential hiccups to stop Aung San Suu Kyi becoming president, how all the democratic leaders were killed just after the British pulled out, and also how so many of that country's Muslim minorities are still living under racist military rule. Also, ukulele teacher and digger, fighter for the commons, Tim Flitcroft joins us to talk about Occupy London's efforts to get away from ownership of property and to talk about stewardship. In other words, if you aren't using your land, buildings or whatever, someone else will. Plus, our weekly What's On Guide and Song of the Week from Jeff Sparks. Dialect is produced by volunteers and broadcast in Bristol on BCFM 93.2 every Friday afternoon. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, whose office is just off Queen Square, and the phone number's 0117 989 7733. Dialect recommends the volunteer-run Bristol Bully Watch helpline, aimed mainly at school children and parents. The number is 01454 318 753. And we'll have a reminder of phone numbers for both Volunteering Bristol and Bully Watch at the end of the show.
Just call me, call
Well, for a moment I've mislaid that CD, but actually it's a very recognisable voice. Oh, there it is, hiding on one of the speakers. That is Bill Withers with Lean On Me. Now, we go to former British colony Burma now to hear about potential hiccups to stop Aung San Suu Kyi becoming president. How all the democratic leaders also there were killed just after the British pulled out, and also how so many of that country's Muslim minorities are still living under racist military rule with the Burma campaign.
My name is Wei Nin and I'm a campaign officer from Burma Campaign UK, and I'm here today to share my opinions and experience about Burma to journalists in this country.
Tell us what the situation is. Many of us have been following Burma at a distance through the eyes of Aung San Suu Kyi. You know, it seems that now she's been freed. The impression is anyway, in this part of the world, that things are looking up in Burma.
Yes, most people seem to think because Aung San Suu Kyi has been free, people think it's a fairy tale of Burma, you know, happily ever after. But the reality on the ground is terrible because there are still many conflicts going on in ethnic area, especially in northern part of Burma, and there are still many political prisoners remain in jail. So I would like to say Burma, changes in Burma is... it's positive change, it's good, and I'm happy with that. But at the same time, it's such a long way to go, and we are just on our first step toward democracy, and we are not there yet.
Now, tell us about the colonial past, because it was actually a British colony, wasn't it, Burma?
Yes, we got independence from British in 1948. The Burmese government is, what they are trying to say is after we got independence from the British, we tried to have a parliamentary system in the country. It failed because our leaders were assassinated even before we got the independence in the country. So they keep saying that all parliamentary system failed. That's why they took over the country in 1962 and they made it, you know, military took over the country. And even now they are trying to, although we have parliament in the country, it's still powerless because military is above of everything and above of parliament and even the president.
So what's the relationship between the forces of democracy, Aung San Suu Kyi, and where does she fit in with that and the military?
Well, she is now a parliamentarian in Burma, and she is hoping to win many seats, and she is hoping to be a president in 2015. And you know, people are very hopeful for that. But at the same time, the question is, according to Burmese law, she can't be a president, although the president said so she could be because she married to a British man. So there are, you know, all the repressive laws still remain in place, and there are some things that Aung San Suu she can do, but there's still the changes in Burma has to be nationwide because it's all only going on in central part of Burma, and in ethnic area people are still dying and people are still, you know, going through such problems and such abuses from the Burmese army.
What about journalism and what about the press? Do you have a free press in Burma?
The censorship law hasn't been repealed in Burma, and people think that everything's fine because journalists in Burma still operate under some of the strictest censorship laws in the world, and only things change is they just change a rule of all the censorship laws.
So how does that censorship work?
Censorship... at first, in about a year ago, you have to submit your article in advance, but now they don't have to do it anymore. But they can't criticise the government, they can't report on the human rights abuses, and they can't report on many politically, you know, sensitive issues.
So everything that people are talking about in the streets, you won't see in the newspapers?
No, you won't see in the newspaper. And reporters and journalists are not allowed to report anything going on in parliament because people in Burma don't know what's going on in parliament, what bill they've been passing. So there is no press freedom and there is no media freedom in Burma because still heavily censored, because even after you wrote an article they can censor it and they can get you arrested for that.
Okay, what are the other issues in the country and what other campaigns is the Burma campaign looking at?
The main campaigns we've been doing is a political prisoners campaign, because there are, we believe that there are many political prisoners remaining in prison. Although, you know, the international community has been praising Deng Xiaoping for releasing hundreds and hundreds of them, but we believe that there are many political prisoners, and we believe that there are innocent civilians being arrested just because they, you know, because they are in a conflict area and they've been arrested for a political reason. So we are asking international community to investigate, go in and investigate how many political prisoners remain in prison and release them as soon as possible.
Now, you've had 50 years of military rule, kind of police state. Can you tell us how soon that's going to end? Do you think there's a real possibility that may happen soon?
I like to be hopeful because it's my country, and I like to see true democracy in my country. But I am not very optimistic at the moment, because all the repressive laws still remain in place, and military is, at the end of the day, is in control of the country. So what President Thein Sein is trying to do is to make Burma into a normal dictatorship, still, you know, very oppressive, but at the same time allowing a little bit of freedom there and there, so that he can have trade and business and sanctions being lifted from the international community. So what I want to say is, if he is actually a genuine reformer, he wouldn't, you know, ask anything back from the international community. He would do these changes regardless of anything as a reward. So all I want to say is, this is a big game, and it's still a very long way to go to get true democracy in my country. So what's been going on now is they allow a little bit of, you know, they say all people are allowed to go on the street and protest about such and such things. But at the same time, there are some rules will be saying you have to say, you know, submit an application in advance of why you want to protest. So people are trying to take advantage of those things. But for example, a month ago, students were trying to have a memorial service for people who died in 1988 uprising, but they were arrested and they were detained overnight because, you know, they were trying to make a memorial service. So, you know, the government, people are trying to push the boundaries. Activists are trying to push the boundaries and see how, you know, although they knew that they would get arrested, they are trying to push the boundaries. And the government being very clever, they don't want to have a bad face. So they are kind of, you know, detaining, not detaining people in central Burma. They release all those activists, but they keep detaining people in ethnic area. They keep arresting people, and some of the, most of them, we don't even know where they are and what they've, what have happened to them.
Well, tell us about these ethnic areas, and why is that different to other parts of Burma?
I think in ethnic area, if you are a journalist and if you are going to visit Burma, you are allowed to go and see what's been going on in central Burma. You're not allowed to go and see what's been going on in ethnic area, because conflicts are still going on and Burmese armies are still attacking, you know, ethnic civilians. And now business and trade can go into Burma, and most of our natural resources come from ethnic area. So, you know, there is no such thing as compensation if they take their land away. So if there is no rules and law in Burmese parliament giving people the right to their land, because at the end of the day, Burmese government own every single land in the country. So I think, you know, most of the natural resources from the ethnic area, and they are trying to invade the village. They burn down the village. They're trying to invade so that they can do business there. And they broke the 17-year ceasefires agreement with Kachin, one of the ethnic group in Burma, last year. And all the conflicts are still going on, and they don't bother to negotiate. They just want to sign a piece of paper and say, okay, let's stop it, and which they can break any time. They don't bother to talk about what's the root causes of the problem. They don't bother to sit down and talk with what ethnic people really want from the changes in the country. So there is no negotiation, because the Burmese government don't ever want to do that.
Tell me about 1988.
1988, there was, people might know that there was a massive uprising in the country, because mainly because there was a lot of oppressive against the students' rights, and the government took away the money because of the superstitious reason. So all the students say, okay, this is enough. You know, we would go out on the street, ask for democracy, economic reform and freedom in the country. As a result, more than 3,000 people have been killed by the military and more than 1,000 people were jailed. And I could say my father was one of the student leader who was arrested. And I was only 5 months old when he was arrested.
Okay, and so when was he released?
He was released in 1996, and he was still very active and campaigning against the dictatorship and for human rights and freedom in the country. And he was arrested again in 2007 and sentenced for 65 years in prison. And he was recently released in January, but on a parole system. But he's still very active, and he knew that if he is put back to prison, he will be going back to prison for 61 years plus new charges and new sentence.
For many people, the only association they have with Burma is a company called Burma Oil. As in the colonial days, I imagine, we were taking a lot of oil from Burma and selling it here in Britain. Is it still a big, powerful natural resource in your country?
Yes, it's still a very much one of the main industry in Burma, and many years, although we've been, you know, putting sanctions and asking company not to do their business, to a total while French companies been going, you know, being business with Burma for many, many years. But now all the sanctions being suspended for a while, and in US they lifted the sanctions, so you know now more businesses and more companies could go into Burma just take natural resources away and, you know, not bother about what the rights of people in the country and not bothering about the compensation or anything. That's what we are worried about. And Aung San Suu Kyi and, you know, we are calling for ethical investment in the country.
And that was the Burma campaign in the former British colony. Rather worrying to hear about how things are developing. Seems with quite a lot of the old British colonial places that we've got problems, haven't we, nowadays? Anyway, on now to our conversation with Jason Yannakopoulos. Jason, you're a disabled activist, and you brought along a bit of history this week about the history of the disabled movement.
Yes, I have.
How far are we going back?
We're going back right to start, but I will think through this for, because I haven't got a lot of time. Really, the first bit of disabled movement started in 1388. This is the before that, you know, disabled people were just ignored by everyone and got often killed horribly. 1388, the Statute of Cambridge came into act, which is a poor law, as many people may know. It's the disabled and older people, it's the first time disabled and older people were considered to be part of the deserving poor and therefore eligible for charity.
Now that immediately brings up the issue, the deserving poor or the undeserving poor.
Yeah.
And I mean, this almost sounds like today in some ways. You know, you're saying 1300s, but that's not totally a million miles away from today, is it?
No,
I mean, they get talked
not.
About. I mean, you know, people get talked about as the deserving and the undeserving, particularly in the Daily Mail and those sorts of newspapers.
Oh,
anyway, sorry to bring you back up to today. We're back in the 14th century.
Well, this is the first time ever that anything really charitable had done for disabled people, and that pretty much carried on throughout 1300. Nothing really changed after that until 1547, when the Priory of St. Mary of Bethlehem gave a hospital to the City of London, which later became the infamous Bedlam Hospital, for the housing of mental patients. It's the first formal institute for disabled people in England in 1547. Now, of course, Bethlehem Hospital was in Lambeth, and it's from that that we get the term Bedlam, as it's known, because it was the first mental hospital, and people referred to it as Bethlam and then Bedlam. So
I mean, it seems that we're sort of conflating, or maybe they were in those days, the physical disability with mental disability.
Well, physical disability was sort of, people almost sort of took a pity on it, while mental disability people just looked at them and thought, well, these are mad people they're mad. So, you know, they're a danger to society. They shouldn't be on the streets. What are you doing here? You know, so sort of, and in a way, that is really horrible, because that would include things like bipolar and autism. And that's really horrific. And that really didn't change for many, 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 many years. In fact, it actually got... In fact, the Industrial Revolution in the 1700s is viewed as a period where everything got better. It actually got worse for disabled people because it was the first time with the Vagrancy Act in 1714, the first time they were actually labelled as lunatics. And then in 1750, this is when the workhouses came in to keep the economically unproductive off the street. So, because it brought a breakdown of rural state and church welfare, Ormond put an end to that. And for those that disabled people that were able to work, they were put into a segregated area for disabled people, to keep them away from the normal people,
Just to concentrate them in places where only disabled people were.
Well, what it says here, it's factory-based work meant an increase in segregation for disabled people unable to work in the new factories, so that would probably be the workhouses.
Now, I also think of those times, particularly going back to medieval times, the first dates you were talking about, as being where people would say, oh, well, if you're disabled, that must be a judgment from God.
Well, yes, absolutely, and even right up to the 1700s, this was still happening, Obviously, your family is sinners and horrible, because look, you have a disabled child, how terrible. And... you just have to look at it, and even some places in America, you still find some people in America, and even some people in the UK who will say this, it's a punishment by God.
And from Germany in years gone by.
Germany. I will come to the Nazi in a bit, because that is a particularly horrible experience. I mean, first of all, I'm going to actually bring us forward to 1845, where we actually had the first... really, the precursor of all disabled rights groups started, which is the first pressure group to defend the liberty of people in autism. Liberty of people in asylums in 1845, and this is the first real fighting back group that was created.
Well, the fact that you're in an asylum means you're kind of in an asylum. Are you saying that some people felt that they should be able to be let out of those asylums, or is it just that they should be treated better while they're in there?
A bit of both. Some people thought that they should be there. Other people thought they should be treated better while in there. And shortly after that, we have British Deaf Association was founded during the same period, by the way. And the National League for the Blind and Disabled, which was established as a trade union for people who are disabled. And so it's the first real concerted effort of a disabled rights movement. It wasn't even known as a disabled rights movement then, because they thought they were still doing charity. So even then, they didn't really consider it to be a rights issue, more of a charity issue.
But hang on a minute. I mean, you've got the sort of things like, the various sort of MenCap and disabled charities now. I mean, what's the difference between then and now? It's still charity. A lot of it is charity, isn't it? I mean, there's obviously government care, some various sorts of social care for disabled people and extra money and that sort of thing. But, I mean, a lot of it is a lot of people, disabled people get help through charity still, Jason.
Well, yes, but these groups back then were more focused on, still focused on more looking after disabled people than the actual actual integration and equality issues. Sort of, they were more based on looking after people than the actual inclusion of disabled people. I don't use the word integration, that means something else, and that's probably what happens now, and what we should really be looking at is inclusion. The first official recognition that the government should act on this came in 1886 with the Royal Commission on the Blind and the Deaf. Now, it's only the blind and the deaf there, so it's only the really physical disabilities it got noticed on. So, people with Asperger's and dyspraxia and things like that would still be sent to Bedlam.
Well, hang on a minute, because they didn't have Asperger's, surely, back that long ago. I mean, that's a relatively modern term and sort of diagnosis by psychologists or psychiatrists, isn't it?
Well, people with Asperger's would have been classified as mad. Still, back then, So
that if they didn't know what you had, you were mad?
Effectively, yes. That's really it. The real change in that came actually just before the First World War with the Mental Deficiency Act, which required local authorities to set up mental deficiency institutions. But even then, it was to set up supervised control and community care. And also following that, the Elementary Education Act a year later, which required local authorities to send... You're going to like this one, Tony. Actually, you're not. Going to send feeble-minded children to special schools unless they were incapable of being taught. Which is... I know you're going to come in now. Here we go.
Yes. Feeble-minded. Now, feeble-minded. I mean, that basically just means people with learning difficulties, doesn't
yes.
it?
And it's... I have to admit, I laughed hollowly when I first read that, and I just thought... wow, you know.
But I mean, I think in some ways it wouldn't necessarily have been an insulting term. It wouldn't have been thought about in those days.
Well, no,
there must have always been a sort of and I think there probably still is some kind of balance, a horrible balance in a way, between people who judge disabled people and others who understand them and have empathy.
Well, absolutely, because. A lot of people judge disabled people, and then this could come back on theatre stuff that we were talking about a few weeks ago. People judge disabled people often view disabled people as different. You know, these aren't people who are looking for equality. These are people who are looking to find because these people work on the medical diagnosis, which actually the original sort of disabled laws looked at medical diagnosis. It's always been based on the medical diagnosis, but medical diagnosis isn't always correct. And that's huge. I mean, a lot of the current medical diagnosis is based on the American system. The American system will look at something like... The American system, the way it looks at it, says, you know, sort of like, all children were born normal. Autistic children just became autistic after they were born. Of course, it's not really like that.
Okay. How about bringing us a little bit closer to the modern world?
Well, if we come to World War II, you know, we had an absolute systematic murder and systematic sterilisation in Nazi Germany, which absolutely brings tears to my eyes. That is really, really, really horrible.
I mean, the Nazis essentially were sort of treating people like animals almost, weren't they? It's like,
absolutely, and, you know, I'm going to move on because that really upsets me. After the Second World War, though, things did get better for disabled people. Disabled Persons Employment Act introduced a green card scheme and segregated. And although works were segregated, it introduced the first legal definition of a disabled person. Now, that wasn't necessarily a good thing because, of course, it followed the medical model, but it was the first time that there was. Really something that people could work on, really something a rights movement could work on there.
It strikes me that quite a lot of what's going on here is disabled people and their friends, their parents, you know, their brothers and sisters and family, trying to just get the whole disabled label removed in a way. It's like saying,
and
well...
that's still the case nowadays. And, you know, and the method they could do at that point was they forced this act, and then, of course, came the 1948 National Health Service Act, which marked the end of the deserving poor charitable approach to disabled people. But even then, you know, we still have charities now. SCOPE was set up in 1952. That is SCOPE, that is the society that overall covered disabled people, was set up in 1952. And this was a real start to equal rights, because it's the first charity that absolutely focused on equal rights rather than just looking after the disabled people. It was, it was, they were the really first people to look at that, and that came out in 1952, so it's only really recently that we've had such a strong table of rights group. In 1966, there was actually a disability rally in Trafalgar Square. Did you know that? No, I was stopped, because I only found that a couple of days ago when I researched this document. I know nothing about that, because it was never covered, really. But the fact is, there was a disability rally in Trafalgar Square, and of course we get that nowadays. If you look at just last year, we had the hardest hit. And it just shows that although so much has been done, you know, the independent living movement came about in the 60s. Chronically Sick and Disabled Persons Bill, which is the first bill to really look at to look at benefits for disabled people within respect to the workplace and so that they could work. It was passed in 1970 and everyone said it's a wonderful thing. An interesting fact about it, though, was it was passed without actually any input from disabled people, so they didn't actually talk to anyone.
Amazing. Anyway, look, I'm going to stop you there, Jason, because we're going to do the rest next week, if that's all right with you.
That is fine.
Because you've got quite a lot. I can see you've got quite a thick bit of paper to get through there, because lots has been happening recently in the struggle for disabled rights, and we're going to continue that one this week. Before that, though, some more Bill Withers.
Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. It's not warm when she's away. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone, and she's always gone too long. Anytime she goes away, wonder this time where she's gone. Wonder wonder if she's gonna to stay. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone, and this house just ain't no home anytime she goes away. And I know, 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 hey, I ought to leave the young thing alone, but ain't no sunshine when she's gone. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. Only darkness every day. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone, and this house just ain't no home anytime she goes away. Anytime she goes away. Anytime she goes away.
Bill Withers there. Ain't no sunshine. Now, a ukulele teacher and digger, he's a fighter for the commons, Tim Flitcroft joins us to talk about Occupy London's efforts to get away from ownership of property and to talk about stewardship instead. In other words, if you aren't using your land, buildings or whatever, someone else will.
My name is Tim Flitcroft. We just put on an event called Reclaiming the Commons, Practical Steps and Galvanising Action. This is part of the Putney debates, so put on by Occupy London. And this particular event is also being put on in cooperation with the School of Commoning, which was started by George Poor.
Now, before you talk about the event, Occupy London, I thought that had all finished. It's been evicted. I think the church evicted you, didn't they?
Well, I think there's a huge misunderstanding about that. I mean, Occupy London was never just the camps. There's a whole back lot of people helping, doing, organising all sorts of things, a lot of things that are quite invisible, really, to the media. And there are all kinds of working groups that met, like, once or twice a week. The media groups, so about three kinds of media groups, Occupy News Network, Occupy Radio, Occupy TV, then there's the Occupy Times.
Now, I mean, I'm particularly interested in this Occupy News Network. Can we get that online?
Yes, you can get that online, and you can become a citizen journalist yourself, and you can submit articles to it, or videos, or interviews. I wouldn't know the actual URL, but if you look up Occupy News Network, ONN, you will definitely find it. And there's quite a few very interesting videos there, who was the ambassador, who talks about whistleblowers, Craig Murray. There's a couple of good interviews about that, particularly in relationship to the Julian Assange case.
Great. Well, what about the commons? Because, I mean, I get a feeling that the commons are being trashed right now. Every time I go down a pavement, it looks like it's in a mess. I mean, it's our basic infrastructure that we all need to share, which is either being privatised or just neglected and left to rot.
Well, this is right. And what our meeting's about was to expand the notion of the commons. So I think we have the idea that, yes, the commons, something you walk over, and that's the kind of something that's left from a long time ago when there was an area of land called the commons, as distinguished from owned land by the aristocrats. And the common land was usually a place where people could graze cattle and do so forth. And then there's another concept of the commons, which is just common pool resource, which is any kind of wilderness. It's just there, and some people use it for all sorts of different things. But what a commons is a resource that's managed by a community.
Now, back in the 1960s, somebody, Hardin, I think, came out with a book called The Tragedy of the Commons. He was saying that inevitably people take too much from the commons. They'll take too much wood from the wood, and eventually it just ends up as a bare patch of land.
Well, I'm really glad you asked that question, because, yes, of course, that was a book or a thinking form that really underlay the kind of neoliberal economist desire to privatise everything. It was a kind of their reason. And we've ended up with this kind of Tina idea that there isn't an alternative. However, Eleanor Ostrom, who's a Nobel Prize-winning economist, did a lot of research into traditional commons communities, and she showed you can exist perfectly well as a community organising yourself with a resource if you adopt certain principles, which she very carefully over a number of years realised that this is what they were doing. And George Monbiot has also shown that when a commons organises itself on a situation, when the market moves in, it can completely destroy the fabric of the ability to use that resource. And that's George Monbiot talking about the Maasai tribesmen in Kenya. So the idea that, in fact, it's a market that's destroying the commons or destroying the planet. The planet is our commons. It's all we have. And it's the market that's destroying the resources, polluting the sea and so forth like this. To reclaim the commons is to start fighting back against the degradation of the environment worldwide.
Now, that also includes things like the air we breathe nowadays, doesn't it? And even genetic material. All of these big corporations want to privatise genetic material. I mean, is there going to be any end to this? It seems that almost everything somebody somewhere wants to own. And if they think they can get a bank loan to do it.
Well, this is a problem. Derek Beaulieu, who's an important activist in the Commons, wrote a paper with somebody called Weston, a lawyer, about the kind of the law surrounding the Commons. And just amongst them, a very rich description of things in there is one of a Native American tribe where they found that their traditional medicines were being taken by a corporation and patented and used and sold back, you know. So what they did was release all their information and produce it under a Creative Commons license so anyone can use any of their medicines. So there are ways to fight back against these kinds of encroachments. But you're quite right. These digital commons, as they're called, have a real-life impact on people. It's not just a question of just having, you know, the ability to download music or something. It's having a real ability on how we control information and share it, which has a practical result in the real world. So the digital commons is probably the main area now of conflict between the commons, which so far has been slightly marginal in terms of the real economy and the market state.
And we also seem to have forgotten the way that we used to use land as one of the most important commons. Certainly that accelerated with the Civil War. It's interesting you're doing the Putney debates because that was a Civil War debate which happened back in the mid-1600s. But our whole idea of land and the way that's managed. One thing I do know is there's a word called stint, which we don't use very much nowadays, and that was effectively the amount you were allowed to use the commons, and that was fairly strictly policed. You know, if you, as a lord of the manor, had too many cows on the land, the lord of the manor was absolutely going to be prosecuted by the common courts, just as any ordinary person would. So it was a level playing field, and we do seem to have forgotten about the way that those common resources used to be managed back before the Civil War. But anyway, what I'm trying to get to say is, to what extent do you think the Civil War was a turning point between the landowning feudal classes and the merchant classes, who are now really, rather than the main resource that we think of being land now, and since the Civil War, it's been money?
Well, that's the way the situation is manipulated, undoubtedly, is through money. I mean, George Monbiot has talked recently about ecosystems where they're trying to describe all natural resources in terms of financial outcomes so that a farmer is now seen as an owner or producer of the river and the sky and the mountains and hills in his area. Another point that Boileau makes out is the way that there is a surplus of money needing investment, that he can't find it in the conventional production streams, basically because we're in a position of overproduction. That's the actual problem in the world. And also distribution, but it's overproduction's problem. So they're looking for all sorts of alternative ways to invest money. And that's this pressure then on monetizing what should be common becomes, you know, something owned. So that's a continual pressure. But I want to say that the thing about the commons is that the main thing it's trying to do is contest ownership as a way of relating to resources. It's replaced by stewardship, which means that people gather in communities and have an equal democratic way of talking about how the resource is used, how it's distributed and so forth. So this is the important idea in the commons, that of stewardship replacing ownership, either by the state or by the market.
And if that doesn't happen, where are we heading?
Well, it's very hard to see. You've got sort of ideas of carbon tax and cap and pay and things like this, but they're all very market-based. And so far, we've not really seen the market actually successfully deal with the erosion of the environment. And I think it's very important that the actual control of the environment is returned to people, because people who are in an environment really do want to preserve it. It needs that kind of intimacy with the environment and with the landscape, because you do need this to be a participatory thing. It can't just be a question of getting a few laws. So I think, and also people see this as a positive thing, whereas something like a tax, a carbon tax, just people just groan and just sort of think that's something they can't relate to. But something where you're being asked to involve yourself in a resource which you believe in, is something people can be positive. So this is a very positive kind of movement, the Commons movement. And it is about changing the structure of land ownership. The group of people who own land in England is now decreasing under the Tories. I think we've got a position now, it's 0.5% own 50% of the land. And 30% or more is not even registered. We've got people like the Duke of Westminster who are owning land, own titles that they inherited 1,000 years ago. I mean, do we really want to live our lives as though we're still living in 1066? I think not. Because the thing about the Commons movement is it's very heterogeneous. It's not... Everyone's doing it bit by bit. It's incremental. It's coming from the grassroots up. It's not some sort of ideology. It's very opposite to that. It's a practice that people have been doing since the 60s, really, to recapture. I mean, the San Francisco diggers is perhaps the first example where it resurfaced.
That was Tim Flitcroft, one of the back workers, as he describes it, for Occupy London, looking at reclaiming the commons. And the websites he recommends, a couple really, School of Commoning, that's schoolofcommoning.com, and also Commons Rising, that's one word, .ning.com. And he also recommends, as he mentioned there, a guy called Derek Bollier, B-O-L-L-I-E-R, who's in London on November the 23rd to launch a book of his. But you can find a lot of material by Derek up on the internet, a lot of articles, and particularly those two websites, schoolofcommoning.com and commonsrising.ning.com. In a moment, Olivia Griffiths standing in for Jeff Sparks.
When I wake up in the morning, love, and the sunlight hurts my eyes, and something without warning, love, bears heavy on my mind. Then I look at you, and the world's all right with me. Just one look at you, and I know it's gonna be a lovely day. Instead of me, always seems to know the way. Then I look at you, and the world's all right with me. Just one look at you, and I know it's gone.
Love it.
Now, I'm fairly sure that Jeff Sparks can't hold his breath that long and sing those long notes like Bill Withers can there with Lovely Day. But maybe Olivia Griffiths can. Because Olivia's standing in for Jeff this week with our What's On guy. Hi, Olivia. What's on this week?
Hello, this is your What's On guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday the 16th of November, the Bowie Experience will be performing at Fiddler's in Willway Street, Bristol. Tickets are £8 in advance and doors open at 8pm. Also on the 16th of November, Adam Ant and the Good, the Mad and the Lovely Posse will be performing with support at the O2 Academy in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Tickets are £25 in advance and doors open at 6:30pm. On to Song of the Week, and I present Rival Sons. This group hail from Los Angeles in USA, and in their career have released 3 studio albums, 1 EP and 4 singles. This is taken from their new album, Head Down, which is out now, and is the forthcoming single titled Until the Sun Comes.
I know you think you've heard it all before, but you will tell the story of tonight. Get it left, get it right, get it up and down. You look through it all, I'll be staring at your eyes. Hey, hey, and we can dance, we can dance until the sun comes up. And we can dance until the sun comes up. Until the sun comes. And if you don't believe what I say, I'll kiss your eyes and you're in doubt. Get it right, get it up and down. This building might burn, but we'll be making out. Hey, hey, and we can dance until the sun comes up. And we can dance until the sun comes up. Until the sun comes. Try to hide, cause I'll be looking out. And we can dance until the sun comes up. And we can dance until the sun comes up. And we can dance until the sun comes up. Until the sun comes.
That was Rival Sons with Until the Sun Comes, which will be officially released on November the 26th from the recent album Head Down. For more information on them, you can check out www.rivalsons.com. Into Saturday the 17th of November, the Urban Folk Quartet will be performing at the Folk House in Park Street, Bristol. Tickets are £10 each and doors open at 8pm. Finally, on Sunday the 18th of November, Keith Warmington, Stuart Gordon and Kit Morgan will all be performing at the Coronation Tap in Zion Place, Bristol. Entry is £3 on the door and the gig starts at 4pm. That's all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Olivia and Jeff there, plugging the BBC Radio Bristol presenter Keith Warmington. Just remind us when that's on again, could you, Olivia?
Sunday the 18th of November at 4 o'clock at the Coronation Tap in Zion Place.
Lovely. That was a bit unfair me springing that on you, but thanks very much at the last minute. That's all for this week. Dialects, a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 2 o'clock every Friday afternoon. If you're outside Bristol on the internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Thursday or Wednesday or even Tuesday nowadays when Dialect goes online. You can sign up for that or download this weekly podcast from our website dialectradio.co.uk. Dialect's a Bristol Radio Co-op production and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, which you can find on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. And as promised, here's the number again for Bristol Bully Watch Helpline, 01454 318 753. That was Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening, so until the same time next week, goodbye.
Thank you.